America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
We're halfway through the Friday edition of The Guy Benson Show from the Hoover Institution here at Stanford this week, our final day here on campus. Very grateful to have you along. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast is always free when the program is over. And with me here in studio at Hoover is Neil Ferguson, Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, author most recently of Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe, which seems rather apt this week. Neil, it's good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Guy.
You made a prediction a number of months ago that you saw a big Middle East war in the cards. And at the time, people said, okay, that's really going out on a limb. Here we are. What made you say that back then? Clearly, you did not anticipate the specific action that has triggered this huge flare-up in the conflict, but you said it for a reason. What was that?
Well, I don't claim to be a Middle East expert, but I like to talk to people who are. And if one looked at what was being said in the region, it was clear that Israel's position was vulnerable in a number of ways. It was getting tied up in the West Bank. It was deeply divided on the complex question of the Supreme Court. And that division, in fact, started to involve the Israeli military. And it's hardly surprising that Iran saw a growing opportunity, especially as the Biden administration has been bending over backwards in a doomed attempt to try to salvage President Obama's nuclear deal with Iran. And in doing so, has actually freed up resources to the Iranians, who've also been selling much more oil than they were able to during the Trump years. So I didn't find it difficult to foresee some kind of explosion in the region. I mean, you're never going to be too wrong if you predict a crisis in the Middle East. They come on pretty regularly.
Fair.
But one other point that's important, a central part of the argument of my book Doom is that one damn disaster leads to another. And if you had a war already raging in Ukraine, distracting and absorbing resources of the West, that increased the probability that another conflict, and maybe more than one, would break out somewhere else.
I wonder if you, in thinking about what you just said, the old, I think, truism, which is that weakness invites aggression. Israel's a strong country, but to your point, they were and have been for a while here a distracted country. And I'm not sure what's going to happen when the dust settles. I think a lot of Israelis are just livid that this was allowed to happen in the South and that signs were missed and the eye was off the ball. But that was true sort of across Israeli society. Is that just a confirmation of, not saying that the Supreme Court there, the court reform and all that is not a real and important issue, but for them to be all consumed with that internally, maybe they just lost sight for a little while of the extreme external threat, which is sort of hard to imagine they could in that region. But even just taking their focus away from that a little bit, that's an opening, right? That's been tragically and horrifically exploited.
Yes. If you're the only democracy in a very unstable region, it's especially hard. And it's been really hard for Israel to have a stable government recently. Elections have been almost an annual event, and no government has been stable. The extensive division caused by the Supreme Court issue has been very striking to me. My Israeli friends, people I thought of as small-c conservative, have been in the streets, literally at rallies, behaving in ways that I found extraordinary. So it was clear to me that something especially unusual was happening in Israel. But I don't think, Guy, that there was some great failure of Israeli intelligence, which is the kind of headline these days. I think Prime Minister Netanyahu knew that something was coming from Gaza because the Egyptians told him, but he underestimated how big it would be. He may even have calculated that a small outbreak by Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad would help the situation in Israel by bringing about national unity. I think he made a great mistake in underestimating what they had up their sleeve. But I don't think it was a failure of intelligence, maybe a failure of analysis. The failure of intelligence was in Washington. Literally a week before these horrific events, these attacks on Israeli civilians as well as service personnel, a week before, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told an audience in the U.S. that things in the Middle East had never been so quiet in two decades, and he was spending much less of his time on the issue than all his recent predecessors. That's the real story to me. It was in Washington that there was a disastrous failure of intelligence. I still can't quite believe he said those words. literally a week before disaster struck.
Well, also within the context of unfreezing $6 billion for Iran that they've, I guess, reportedly now refrozen temporarily. Who knows what the reality is there. But they have continued down this obsessive path to try to bring back the Obama policy. And it just seems naive isn't even the word. It's just delusional. And they keep doggedly pursuing it. They still won't really blame Iran for what happened in Israel. 27 Americans have been killed so far.
There are hostages.
Yes.
Remind you of anything? Look, the incredible thing to me is the extent to which this administration has tried to resuscitate an obviously dead deal. Not only has it done that, in the process, it has undermined the progress that was being made in the region that produced the Abraham Accords. It's almost certain now that the reconciliation or rapprochement between Israel and Saudi Arabia won't happen.
There are reports of that today.
The Saudis are having to go along with the Arab street and engage in the kind of hysterical response that we see now all over the region against Israel. So the Iranians have already achieved one of their objectives. But there's something more troubling going on here, which I don't think we're discussing nearly enough. And that is the extent, which has been reported in some news outlets, the extent to which an Iranian influence operation successfully managed to penetrate the U.S. government. Now, this would be front page news if we had real journalists. The only person in the New York Times to refer to this extraordinary story is Brett Stevens in his column. It's basically absent from the news pages. So it's not just that they tried to resuscitate something that was pretty obviously dead. It's worse than that. It feels almost as if a part of the government became much too close to the Iranian government, almost became captured by its counterparty. And what's odd to me is how little attention this gets. I can't help feeling that if somehow or other something like this had happened under the Trump administration, we would have had it wall-to-wall, 24-7.
No, we were told about collusion endlessly with Russia, which was not true.
Yeah.
That was wall-to-wall for years.
Right.
It was a singular fixation of almost the entire news media. Here's some
apparent collusion. Right.
With Iran.
And we have the emails. We actually have emails to an official in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard from somebody who continues to work in the Pentagon as chief of staff to a senior official. So for me, the whole coverage of the crisis in Israel is missing the point. There wasn't a failure of intelligence in Jerusalem. There was a failure to gauge how big the threat would be, how big the attack would be. But there's something else going on in Washington which is really disturbing. And that is, you used the word collusion. I might not go that far. But certainly something funny is going on when your Iran envoy has to have his security clearance suspended pending investigation. We need to talk more about that because it smells very, very rotten to me.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that the Biden administration writ large was colluding with the Iranian regime. I think they were trying to achieve some goals and doing things outrageous in support and pursuit of those goals. And there were at least, allegedly, several well-placed people within the administration who were, I think it is fair to say, colluding on some level with Iran.
Well, they were certainly communicating with the Iranian government in ways that certainly don't sound appropriate for U.S. officials.
And asking permission to do things
right.
and to travel certain places, and there are rumors about what Mr. Malley was up to, which gets much, much closer to the definition of the word that I used. So it should be a huge story. It is one. You used the term disturbing a moment ago. On that note, here at Stanford, there was a lecturer just suspended because this person, while trying to indoctrinate students about the conflict in Israel, asked Jewish students to go stand in a corner in the classroom and say, "That's what colonizers do, and Israel is a colonizer." That is insane. That person has been suspended. This school has, not Hoover, but Stanford, has declined to comment institutionally on the slaughter of 1,300 Jews. My alma mater, Northwestern, has done the same thing, refusing to comment institutionally. And the president at Northwestern said, moving forward, we're not going to comment on all of these things. We're going to comment on things directly related to our school, and that's it, which is fine. I actually support that, except that has not been the standard for many years. They comment on everything.
Yeah.
They comment on every controversy, often at the beck and call of left-wing activists on campus. And it just seems kind of disgusting to me that the catalyst to institute this new principle, so-called, of no comment, is the death of well over 1,000 Jews. Right. That's when suddenly they clam up. There's something deeply off there, I think.
There sure is. Some of us have been worrying for a long time about the decline of standards in American academic life. Now, it seems to me that one of the most important standards that one should uphold as a professor at a university is to keep politics out of the classroom. The great German sociologist Max Weber made this argument 100 years ago in a fantastic essay called Science as a Vocation, Learning as a Vocation, arguing that there really could be no place for politics in the lecture room because you abuse your power as a professor if you start engaging in activism. Now, over recent years, certainly in the 20 years that I've been working in American universities, this has been happening to an extraordinary extent. Blatant political discrimination, blatant and self-conscious activism, quote-unquote, on the part of certain professors, and an acquiescence in this behavior by university presidents and provosts. Now,
And in some cases, not even just an acquiescence, a participation.
Right, and it's led to, well, not only the case that you mentioned, but I think a plethora of examples of really bizarre responses to the atrocities and acts of terror that we witnessed last weekend in Israel. Now, I agree with something you said a minute ago. It is not appropriate for university presidents to editorialize on every political issue of the day. That is not their job. But you're quite right to say that it's funny that they should suddenly decide that after their full-throated endorsements of Black Lives Matter in 2020, their equally enthusiastic endorsements of the defense of Ukraine in 2022. Only now do we decide that we should be circumspect. Only now are university presidents going to mind their language. I find that really extraordinary.
Why? So, why is that happening? Why? Are they afraid? I was just on Fox News Channel earlier today, and they played a montage of shrieking, deranged students openly supporting Hamas and spreading utter lies about Israel. They are an extremely loud group. They are a combustible group. We've seen some incidents of violence on campus against pro-Israel and Jewish students already, horribly. Are the universities scared of those people? Are they afraid to violate intersectionality, and the highest form of intersectionality on the left is now supporting Hamas? Is it money? In the case of my university, there's a campus in Doha. They take a lot of money from the Qatari government. I don't know. Are a bunch of anti-Semites running these institutions? I find that hard to believe. I don't want to believe that. What's the constellation of factors leading to this double standard and cravenness?
It's often said that universities are always on the left, that they're kind of liberal strongholds, always have been. That's not quite right. I think it's fair to say that the universities have moved decidedly leftwards over the last 20, 30 or so years. Each generation is somehow further to the left of the one that hired it and tenured it. And that means that there's just a massive disproportionate skew towards not just Democrats, but democratic socialists, and a near extinction of conservatives on the great majority of campuses. And this is clearly demonstrated in the statistics. Now, that creates a particular climate, and the climate is essentially one in which left-wing opinions can be expressed, often very loudly, but opposing opinions get silenced. There's a lot of self-censorship where there isn't outright pressure to cause people to be silent.
And because those other opinions are deemed to be problematic, dangerous, causing unsafeness among
right.
people who might hear those opinions, and then you create an environment where you have people chanting for the death of Jews, effectively, and there is evidently no concern for the safety, literal safety in some cases, of Jewish students or people who might dissent from that view. It's an irony that also happens to be quite sick.
I think it's best explained by a curious convergence that in some ways makes no sense, and that convergence is between the old Marxist left, of which there still are relics, and the Islamist movement. Now, what's odd about the left and the Islamists is they really don't have anything in common.
Except hating the West and Western
well,
values.
That turns out to be the unifying factor, and particularly hating the State of Israel and, by extension, Jews. And so you get this very toxic alliance between radical leftists and Islamists, And they because they disagree about everything else. I mean, on gay rights, for example, it's hardly plausible that Islamists would make common cause with the campus left. But because they disagree on so many issues, they can focus on one thing, and that thing is anti-Zionism. Now, I think university leaderships have been running scared of the radical left for a long time. And it's partly because of the tactics that they adopt. If you think back just a few years to, say, the Halloween affair at Yale, when a professor like my friend Nick Christakis is surrounded by a hostile mob of students who harangue him in a menacing way, you'd have expected the president of Yale University to step in, discipline the
and
students.
And by the way, they did that because he suggested that maybe we shouldn't over-adjudicate Halloween costumes.
It was crazier than that. His wife suggested that there shouldn't be too much concern about cultural appropriation. This transmogrified very quickly into accusations, wild accusations of racism, directed at Nicholas Christakis himself. And I remember watching the scenes as he was harangued. He bore it with tremendous patience, thinking, this should not be allowed. I mean, this is really outrageous. And there was no disciplinary action taken against those students. In fact, some of them received prizes. So what has happened is that university authorities have appeased the radical left on campus, while at the same time generally dealing harshly with conservative student groups. And the result is where we are today,
yes,
where the Hamas flags can be flourished on campuses, and university presidents can't find themselves the language to condemn acts of terrorism that, to me anyway, recall the most hideous excesses of the Holocaust. That ought to be easy to condemn,
to
but
everyone.
Somehow not.
Yep.
Somehow not.
Neil Ferguson, senior fellow here at the Hoover Institution, my guest on the Guy Benson Show. Neil, thank you.
Thanks, Guy.
We'll be right back.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.